Okay. Welcome, everybody. Just to encourage you before we start to go in the back, take a drink, have one sandwich for the moment. If we're not more numerous, there is a second serve that can take place. I'm very happy to welcome you. We'll wait until another 5 minutes to let people move from other sessions, but we'll start in just a couple of minutes. Does anybody want something here? Do you want a drink or anything? I know. Some are overlapping, but that's... I encourage everybody, when you sit, to sit as much forward as possible. No, I have one. That's okay. Maybe just a little less loose. Just a little less. Because otherwise I don't see. Perfect. So just encourage you to come and move forward and close so that it's a little more cozy. I'm not very fond of the classroom distribution, but as everything is wired and bolted almost to the ground, it's hard to change the disposition of the room. Maybe I'll take those few minutes to just introduce myself, because the ones that will come afterwards then will not miss too much. I'm Bertrand de la Chapelle. I am the special envoy for the Information Society in the French Foreign Ministry. I've been following the WSIS process in its entirety in a different capacity as a civil society actor. And I'm now in this function since October 2006, which is about a year ago. I am the French representative in the Governmental Advisory Committee of ICANN. I am the head of delegation here, if there is such a thing as head of delegation at the IGF. I am also the French representative in the Commission on Science and Technology for Development, which is partly in charge of the follow-up to the World Summit on the Information Society. My general mission is basically to handle issues that are related to the post-WSIS, post-World Summit on the Information Society matters, and internet governance issues in general. You have on your seat, and if you don't, please ask people who are distributing them, two documents. One is the small three-fold paper, which actually has one interest, which is one of the pages allows you to write down remarks or comments, give your name, your email address if you want to be updated on what comes afterwards. It is obvious that we will never have time to exhaust the subject, and I'm just afraid that people in the room will want to contribute additional things, and I don't want you to be frustrated, so please use this page to give input. And the second set of pages is the bios of the different panelists, so that we don't have to make a full introduction. I encourage you to look at the bios and look at the pictures. It helps connect people with who they are. I must confess that I'm very, very proud and pleased to have this lineup. There are many. We don't have that much time, but we'll try to have an interesting exchange. So maybe we can, in order not to have too much noise, start, because we're now in reasonable time. You see here the title. Apparently it was sufficient to bring you here, so I hope you're interested in the issue. The IGF in general is about two different type of things. One is substantive issues, and there are many workshops and many sessions that are related to substantive issues, and it's important. And there's another dimension, which is methodology and process. We are more addressing the methodology and the process here. As a matter of fact, a lot of actors, and probably you in your daily life in many cases, are confronted with the challenge of establishing consultations that are inclusive enough, but efficient as well. Because you know that there is a tit for tat. The more inclusive you are, the harder it is to make it relatively rapidly and to be really producing results. This is the kind of thing that we are addressing here. And many organizations are facing this challenge, and we hope that the exchange will outline a few ideas that you can reuse in your professional activities and in the other organizations you participate in. The focus is, it says policy development, the focus, as you will see, is on the very early stages of policy development. As you see in the papers, it's about agenda setting, issue shaping, formation of working groups at the very early stages. To go through the bios rapidly, the lineup of people here, we tried to have people who are from diverse backgrounds. Some are from international organizations, some are involved in standards organization, they're from civil society, from government. They share a certain number of traits, and two of them are that they have been, most of them, engaged and involved in the WSIS process, and some still bear the bruises of the battles that were there. And another element that is more important for me, they are deeply committed to the issue and to those issues in general. They have devoted a lot of time to them, and sometimes many years before the WSIS and afterwards, and you'll see in the paper that was distributed and in their presentations that sometimes the experiences they want to refer to date back to 10 years or 15 years ago, and it's interesting to see the perspective. Very quickly, I'm very happy to have organized this workshop with four co-sponsors. In no particular order, I can start from the right. Thomas Schneider, who is here, is representing Ofcom, which is the Federal Office of Communications in Switzerland. And Switzerland, as you know, has been the host of the first phase of the summit, of the World Summit on the Information Society, and is deeply engaged and involved in supporting the IGF here. APC is the Association for Progressive Communications. Karen Banks here is representing APC, and you can see her bio on the paper. APC is a network of organizations that are dealing with ICTs and has been very engaged in the WSIS as well, in particular in supporting the organization of civil society. Likewise, Congo, which is the coordination of NGOs in consultative status with the United Nations, is represented here by its president, Renate Bloom, here, who also was very much involved in the WSIS, but also in many other UN processes. And last but not least, BASIS, which is an International Chamber of Commerce initiative that is Business Action to Support the Information Society. It's a group that has been formed after the WSIS to continue to engage the business sector. And Aisha Hassan, was here in the front, is actually organizing and managing this action. And I have the pleasure also to say that she's my life partner, and it's a great pleasure to have here. You here, I love you. I'm not running for Congress, but doesn't matter. I really appreciate the support of those co-sponsors, both on the intellectual and on the practical basis. The food over there is courtesy of the Swiss government, so thank you very, very much. And part of the documents that are reproduced here have been reproduced with the help of ICC as well. Now, I continue rapidly. You have the different presentations. The other panelists I take in the order. David Apasamy is from an Indian company called SIFI. Valerie Costa is the program manager of InfoDev at the World Bank, and she's from Singapore. David is from India. Valerie is from Singapore, and she has been involved in the WSIS as the Singapore representative. Daniel Dardaillet is the associate chair of the World Wide Web Consortium. He's French and is based in the south of France. On the initial program, you had Paul Levins from ICANN, and we have the pleasure to actually expect Peter Denget-Thrush to join us after the main session is finished. He is a barrister from New Zealand and recently elected the chairman of the ICANN board. Avery Doria is an adjunct professor at Luleå University of Technology in Sweden. She's been involved in many standards organizations, and she has been involved also in helping the organization of the IGF, but it's not in this capacity that she will be speaking here today. Augusto César Gadelha Vieira is the National Secretary for Information Technology Policy in the Ministry of Science and Technology in Brazil, and also the manager in that capacity of the CGI.BR, which is the multi-stakeholder entity managing the .BR. Arthur Reilly is the senior director. Oh, sorry, I admit senior director twice. You're twice a senior director, sorry. Strategic Technology Policy at Cisco System. He's been involved in many activities of regarding standardization and is involved in the electronic and business IT and technology committee of ICC. Morgan Schmidt is the director of UNESCO's Division of Freedom of Expression, Democracy and Peace. And I am the moderator, and I'll try not to speak too much, which is my natural tendency. So slap me if I do that. I have one slide afterwards. But before, I'd like to start the discussion by asking the different panelists, almost in random order, to mention one personal experience regarding multi-stakeholder activities or policy development that they want to address a little bit later on. Not to elaborate on them now, but just to say, I'd like to speak about this. Maybe I'll start. Danielle, would you just mention it? It's a good opportunity to check if the mics are working.
Yeah, thanks. So, something that I wanted to mention and when Bertrand talked to me about this panel is that W3C and IETF have this particularity that they designed their process using the same tools that they use to design their specification. That's important because it gives you the same level of quality for your process as for your production, in a sense. You have the same people and the same sort of constraint on a various step from last call to implementation to testing that you have with a technical spec, and that's very good in the end for the process that we end up with. So I don't know if other organizations that are not producing technical specification have looked at our way of doing that, or if they have come up with something different.
If you can, actually in the sector when you're promoting a product, there's an expression that is basically you eat your own dog food. Meaning that if the company that is selling a product is using it for itself, it's usually a good sign. So if you use your own process to design something for others, for yourself, it's normally good. Avery, could you?
Okay. Yes. The experience I have is not of being in any one particular multi-stakeholder group. And I think that it's certainly an experience I share with Bertrand, but share with many others. And that's the carrying around so many different hats that you actually start to have your own multi-stakeholder personality. And that you basically, for example, last week I was chair of a council at the ICANN meeting of the GNSO. This week, and you know, that's one particular kind of role. Here I come and I'm a consultant to the secretary, a very different role. Getting email at the moment from the IETF working group where I'm editing a document because I'm in trouble because that document is late, and that's a different role. And I think many of us, you know, and I've gone to WSIS with a government badge, I've gone with a civil society badge, I've gone now to this. So I think for many of us, as we move through different associations, different work, you know, we find ourselves needing to take on very different roles. And it gets sometimes quite confusing, I think, certainly to me, but to other people. Sitting in a room where I'm being the, you know, a silent consultant that doesn't say anything at a meeting, hearing myself quoted from another context where I could say something. And so I think that's a big part of the multi-stakeholder. As you get more and more into it, you get more and more aspects of what you're doing and who you are that you have to juggle.
Renata Congo.
Thank you. I think I'm still one stakeholder at the moment, and not just at the moment. I have been with the UN processes. And I think what is interesting to see, when I started at the UN, that was, I mean, and it is foremost and mainly government-driven. So it is, although we say we the peoples, the UN Charter starts that way, it is still a government-oriented organization. But nevertheless, it was already at the beginning that civil society put something into the charter, and that allowed us later on to really be somehow being consulted. And I think we are moving now into something which is more a partnership. But let me say just at this time, when I started and why I started, and I'm so passionate there, that in the end of the 80s, there was, when I started to represent, say, the World Federation of Women of the Methodists, I heard that something was happening in South Africa where children were a nuisance during the apartheid and thrown into the prison and had no assistance whatsoever. So there was a program of these Methodist women in South Africa, and they helped and gave them legal and social assistance and brought that to me, and I said, do something at the UN. So I brought it to the Commission on Human Rights, and they said, oh, you know, there is just next door, there is a working group drafting the Convention on the Rights of the Child. You should go there, and somehow made it heard. Of course, I could not, as civil society, do something directly, but I had an issue, and I had to know with whom I had to speak, and I had to lobby the government, and the government brought it to the forefront to make it sure. Today we have an article in that convention, and the convention has been adopted by 190 states. And so something which was at the local level is now in an international standard-setting instrument and has wide-ranging influence for children all over the world. So that was a powerful example for me to get involved.
As you have the mic, can you move? Karen, I must say that I tried to introduce gender balance. We're still 4 out of 11. At least some of them are so active in the gender issues that maybe it compensates a little. Karen.
4 out of 11's not bad. That's okay. It's better than we've had in the past. I want to my personal experience is about how important it is to develop trust with individuals from different stakeholder groups in addressing specific challenges. And my experience is very much drawn from being a member of the Working Group on Internet Governance, which was an extraordinary experience. And for me, the first time I had an opportunity to really get to know, both on a personal and a sort of stakeholder level, the different perspectives, the different positions of governments from different parts of the world, of private sector representatives, of international organizations, of the internet community. And I want to specifically talk, I think, about the mechanism of these quite small multi-stakeholder working groups as an important tool in addressing specific challenges that we're dealing with, and certainly, I think, in the context of the IGF as well.
Augusto.
Thank you very much, Bertrand. Well, I would like actually to convey and express here the very rich experience we have been in Brazil on a multilateral, transparent, democratic, and multi-stakeholder, let's say, administration of internet in Brazil. I would actually recall that in the late 80s, almost 17 years ago, we were in the starting of internet in Brazil, and I accompany these first steps of internet in Brazil through the connection of Bitnet, which was in Brazil just the first step to open for internet. Just 1 or 2 years afterwards, after that, we had the first internet connection here in Brazil. And so we started a big experience on that. And I would say that at that time, we were in a kind of a democratic fever in Brazil. We have just closed a part of our history, which was based on some dictatorship, which was being changed for a democratic government. And so we were open to everybody trying to participate and have a saying on that. And so the structure of internet in Brazil, which was based on representation of government, civil society, business, and the academic environment, the academic society, which was actually where internet started in Brazil and in other countries in the world. Today, it's a very good experience. I think that we have achieved a very good level of services to the people, to the country, which can be translated by the fact that 90% of the domains which are registered in Brazil today are under the .br domain. So, contrary, I think, to many other countries where this percentage is much lower, we have actually conquered the hearts and minds of Brazilians to deal with us. So this is something which I would like to have an experience. I am very to share with you this experience, and I am very glad I have this opportunity for already 2 years being ahead of the committee, steering committee, that is administering the .br domain. Thank you.
We'll have you come back. Danielle?
I just want to add that W3C just opened an office in Brazil at CGI, you know, Nick. So here you see sort of like, you know, the fruits of...
Excellent. Wow, good to know. Thomas.
Thank you. I want to share with you quickly a national experience with regard to multi-stakeholder processes that we had in Switzerland. In 2003, upon the request of some civil society representatives, we decided to have a multi-stakeholder platform on national level to discuss our role as a host country for the first phase, but also to work on the text, work on the draft declaration and action plan. And this worked very well, and everybody had the feeling that although we did not agree on everything, that kind of our Swiss contribution has very much improved through the input of the other stakeholders, and this was a good experience. And then in the run-up to the first phase, we decided that not only our paper should maybe be a little bit more multi-stakeholder, but also our delegation should be multi-stakeholder. And we invited civil society and business representatives to be part of the Swiss delegation. But since we were quite occupied with trying to keep this summit going, we did not really think about what that meant, neither we nor did the civil society and the business people. And we ended up with having big problems, especially with regard to communication. So, for instance, while 3 weeks ahead of the summit, the Swiss delegation, especially Mark Fuhrer, was traveling around the world to try to convince CEOs and presidents to come to Geneva because this summit was very important. At the same time, and other members, civil society members of Swiss delegation, held a press conference saying that the WSIS was going to be a failure and it was not necessary to go there because they didn't see everything they wanted represented in the document that were not finished yet. This created a kind of tension, to say the least, on national level. And after the summit was over, we sat together, all the three, and discussed what went good, what went wrong. And we decided basically we were discussing whether we should, for the second phase, should introduce some rules, some speaking orders that the delegation members, non-governmental delegation members, should be bound to, things like that. And we agreed that it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to have civil society people, especially in a delegation, which binds them to kind of stick to the carefully negotiated governmental position, because they have a different role. Their role is to say that we do not accept that, we do not agree with that, even when you don't like it and when it doesn't make you work easier sometimes. But we agreed to not have any non-governmental stakeholders in our delegation anymore, but we kept the whole structure, the whole informal structure behind that. They were invited to all our meetings. We had extensive discussions and coordination every morning in Tunis or every evening or whenever it was. We were coordinating, and we were even starting to use our different roles when we shared the same goals. I think this is what Karen just had said. It needs a certain knowledge of these roles in order to create trust between the different stakeholders. And only when you know what your limits are, what your goals are, what your interests are, what your structure is, then you can come up with a constructive cooperation and. There are examples, for instance, the ITU is now trying to think about being more easily accessed by other stakeholders than business, who is already quite present in ITU. It's the same thing all over again. Those who do not have experience with civil society are more afraid that this might disturb the process and for legitimate reasons sometimes. But I think you have to start doing something and then learn while doing.
I think one element, not only is it proven that integrating all actors in one official delegation is probably not the way to go. I'd be happy to ask Thomas later on, because he's involved in different processes in both ITU and Council in Europe, which have different methodologies. Valerie.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. Is it morning?
Well, so. Sort of.
Good afternoon. I'm going to share two experiences with you, just to be different. The first had to do with the WSIS process when I was in my previous job representing the government of Singapore. And through that process of representing Singapore, the Singapore government at WSIS, I found myself in the position of chairing the working group that created the IGF, where we are right now. So I had, I think at that point of time, and even till now, a vaguely maternal feeling towards this forum, because I chaired that debate. And it was a difficult debate under quite tense circumstances, for those of you who are involved in WSIS will recall. But I wanted to share that experience with you because in the midst of all of those discussions with so many voices clamoring to be heard, I got the strong sense then, as I continue to have now, that we weren't just drafting another resolution or another output to create a new forum. We were embarking on an experiment in international discourse which was going to change the way we view different stakeholders and their relative roles and value to us. And I was a government representative at the time, but I thought to myself then, man, if this could work, this could be very, very powerful. And I think it tapped into a sense I had at that point that when it was just us governments or just the private sector or just the civil society talking to one another, there was value. But the real alchemy came when everyone sat together, and it would be painful. But I felt then, as I continue to feel now, although I've left the government of Singapore, that if this experiment in international collaboration can work, it could mean something pretty amazing. I have a very historic sense about us being here. 2 months after WISIS ended, I left the Singapore government and I took on the role of program manager of InfoDev, which is housed at the World Bank. The bank is one of our donors, but we also have about 9 countries that put money into InfoDev for ICT for development. One of the programs that InfoDev runs, which I want to also tell you about, is a network of 85 business incubators across the world. They're in 53 different countries. And there we hothouse small and medium enterprises, people who want to use ICT to create innovative services and products and to bring them to market. Their InfoDev's constituents and clients are grassroots organizations. They're entrepreneurs. They are people who have a great idea and need some help to bring it further. I found myself going from incubator to incubator, meeting these people. Here in Brazil, we work with an amazing array of incubators through a partner called Amprotech. For those of you who don't know them, please go and find out. They're amazing. And they've said to us, can you work with us to try and create a policy dialogue with government on what it means to have innovation as a policy principle? So here you have a grassroots effort to try and influence policy setting in government that I'm very excited about, but it seems to me that it's exactly the reverse of what I was doing in my last job. And so this is going to be, I think, a very interesting experiment to see if we can actually, through our grassroots incubators, help to get a dialogue going with developing countries to think about why it's important to focus on an innovation policy and what that could mean. So if I can share these stories with you and participate in a debate, that will be why I'm here. Thank you.
Thanks, Valeria. I think this is a perfect illustration, and you already had it in a few interventions before, what I meant by commitment. Most of the people who are on this panel share something that I feel very deeply as well, is the importance of the exercise that we're in right now, which is a very fragile experiment, but a pretty exciting one. Art.
Thank you very much, Bertrand. The experience I'd like to share with you this afternoon is related to some activities back in the 1980s, which in the telecommunications industry was a very turbulent area. And I'm sure Vint here on the front row could tell you about some of the things relative to the Internet Society, but relative to telecom and the infrastructure that supports the TCP/IP and the Internet. Back in the 80s, within the U.S., there was the divestiture of AT&T, or the breakup of the Bell system, which meant that there was no longer one entity to create standards in the U.S. In the same time frame in Japan, NTT decided to sell some of the Japanese government decided to sell some of the NTT shares, privatize, and that caused in Japan the formation of a standards body. In the U.S., called TTC. In the U.S., the group is now called the Alliance for Telecommunications Industry Solutions, ATIS, for U.S. telecommunications standards. And then again, in that same time frame within Europe, the desire to form a more unified market with regard to telecom led to the formation of the European Telecommunications Standards Institute, or ETSI. So by the end of the 1980s, there were 3 regional groups: ATIS in the U.S., TTC in Japan, and ETSI in Europe. And there's a great deal of concern around the world that each of these were focusing on their domestic or their inter-regional issues, and that could lead to a situation in which the global standards could suffer as a consequence. And prior to that, everyone looked to the ITU to provide the standards, and so that was a real concern. And so then, at that point in time, ATIS in the U.S. decided that in order to deal with this, what we would do would we would invite our colleagues from ETSI in Europe and TTC in Japan to get together with us along with the ITU and to work together to promote global standards. And I won't go into all the details. I'll talk about the process hopefully going forward. But there are lots of challenges in doing that, which obviously has that good intention of trying to bring together these regional groups that have the potential to go off in different directions and rather have them focus not only on solving their domestic or regional problem, but also work on collaboration to promote interoperability globally. But obviously, you can imagine if those three organizations get together, even with the ITU, there are those on the outside who are not in that process. And so we had to deal with a range of issues in terms of opening up the process to allow others to be part of it, at least in the form of observers, so they could recognize that this promotion of global standards was our objective and not something in which we would write our own standards independently. So through the course of this discussion, perhaps I can bring out additional issues. Thank you, Bertrand.
Thank you. Morgans.
Thank you, Bertrand. I represent UNESCO, which is a child or a grown-up in the UN family. It's an intergovernmental organization, and by default, we are run by member states. But it's important to remember that member states are more than governments. Member states are the whole society in each and every country, including the private sector, including the NGOs, including, of course, also the various authorities. And we would get nowhere in an organization like UNESCO dealing with issues such as education, culture, communication, and the sciences if we did not had systems that would bring us into contact with all the various stakeholders in the different countries where we're working. And I could mention actually numerous examples here on the way that we do collaborate in a multi-stakeholder environment, both when it comes to the part of our work that has to do with standard setting and also when it comes to our operational work in the field and through all our colleagues working in our field offices. I shall mention maybe just one example now, and then I can come back to maybe some others later on. And that goes also some 15 years back now when we set up what is called the International Freedom of Expression Exchange Network, which is a network which right now monitors violations on freedom of expressions in more than 150 countries worldwide. That's being done by people working in these countries. It's being set up in a collaboration between intergovernmental organizations like UNESCO, representatives from human rights organizations, especially press freedom groups, professional organizations, both from the union side or from the publishers, the broadcasters, and also the media enterprises themselves, the people running the newspapers, the people running the radios, the people being very, very active in this field. Together they have created a network which works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, providing more than 15,000 alerts over a year with information about violations, large or smaller ones, all over the world. And this is free for everybody. So this is like a very concrete outcome from such a multi-stakeholder collaboration. It's a little bit the same model that was used recently, 5 years ago, when the International News Safety Institute was created to promote the safety of journalists, something which is being increasingly important in the world. Also there, UNESCO and some other intergovernmental organizations could use their facilitating power to bring together all the stakeholders so that they would sit together and try to do something for the common best. But I could also mention ICTs for teacher training. I could mention the work with archivists and librarians on preservation of digital heritage and so on. All of that would be impossible if we had not been able to establish the collaboration. And let me just end with a more process-oriented remark, because this kind of collaboration cannot be something ad hocish. It has to be something which works from the very, very beginning, from the very conceptual phase and all the way through. It's not something that we do on and off when we think we need an input, like we need it from a consultant or something. We need to develop structures within our own organizations that ensure that we have this kind of interface with the various stakeholders. At UNESCO, we have that very formalized through UNESCO national commissions in the individual countries and with a system of system for NGOs to be closely connected to UNESCO at several levels. But all of that I can come back to later on.
Thank you, Morgans. The notion that actors have to be included at a very early stage is a very good segue for something that we'll be addressing later on. David, personal experience.
Thanks, Bertrand. The experience I'd like to share with you is one that it's ongoing, but it began about 6 years ago at the Federation of Indian Chambers of Commerce and Industry. 6 years ago, the internet was in a fairly nascent stage in India. And I don't think there was enough being done by the government to nurture the growth of the internet. I suspect that they viewed it as a nuisance. It democratized information. At that time, they were all about control and withholding information. So this was something that they were very wary of. But at the Federation of Chambers of Commerce, we were deeply aware that the future lay with the internet and with e-commerce over the internet, and that we needed to do something to evangelize, particularly within government, the need to increase internet penetration and create an ecosystem so that e-commerce could flourish. So we put together a task force. And the experience I really wanted to share was, you know, the number of people who were on this task force, we kind of looked around and said, who all are interested in e-commerce? And of course, SIFI, which is the company that I represent, which is the largest internet and network services and company in India, was certainly interested. And we were kind of given the lead on this. But we brought in, you know, hardware manufacturers. We brought in large corporations that were already doing e-commerce, like the Steel Authority, who were selling steel online, if you can believe that. We brought in portals. We brought in other ISPs. We brought in computer manufacturers. We brought in software companies like Microsoft and even consultants. So when you look at this group, what we were trying to do meant different things to different people. So we had to decide what we were going to call this task force. And that was a very, very interesting experience because each person came up with their own framework of reference and therefore what it should be called. That was an enormous learning experience. I'll probably go into that deeper as we go along. But suffice to say, instead of talking about online, instead of talking about e-commerce and all of that, we finally chose to call it the e-business task force. Because at the end of the day, that communicated accurately what we were all about, particularly to government. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Peter, a personal experience that is not yet related to your new function of chair, but maybe to a past experience, either in New Zealand or in setting up, I don't know, go ahead.
Thank you, Bertrand. Multi-stakeholder is easy for me because I come from New Zealand. And for those of you who don't know, New Zealand was the last major landmass on the planet to be inhabited by humans. And so there's some question about that. I said inhabited but not civilized. The indigenous population of Polynesians arrived only about 1,000 years ago, and European civilization really takes off from about 1840 when there was a treaty signed with the indigenous people. So New Zealand culture is built up on a multi-stakeholder model right from the beginning. But to bring it slightly closer to this exercise, let me just relate the experience I had in becoming involved with the CCTLD community in ICANN. These are the country code managers, and I see Demi Getchko is here. There's country code managers wherever you go. Demi's part of the group that manages .br, and I was part of the group that manages .nz. And we met in ICANN for the first time as we tried to grapple with what this problem of global internet governance was. Let me just explain, there are 243 different country code managers. Trying to find common ground was almost impossible. Not only do we all speak different languages, but we all come from totally different cultures, legal systems, jurisdictions. There wasn't even a common operating model. Some are run by governments, some were run in a private partnership with governments, some were completely privately owned, and continuing the P theory, some of them were run by pirates outside the country that had been taken over. So we had an enormous difficulty. They were always the largest group meeting in ICANN, and trying to work out how to take things forward was a great difficulty. I learned my lesson when, in a meeting that I was chairing, We had dispatched some representatives to deal with the ICANN Finance Committee to try and calculate how much money the individual country code managers should be contributing to the ICANN budget. And we had appointed two people, and they had gone away with a level of contribution that we had roughly agreed. When they came back, they reported that they had actually decided to double the contribution because they thought this would be really good to have this money going into the ICANN budget and then being spent on developing countries. Well, this was contrary to their instructions. And so we had to deal with that, and in the way that the English speakers wanted to deal with it was to pass a motion of no confidence in the delegates to the Finance Committee. Well, the Asian members were really offended at the idea that we would treat any of our own delegates that way. The concept of a motion of no confidence was completely alien. And they managed, with diplomacy, to water that down to a situation where the vote was that we not receive the report coming back from the delegates. In other words, we were going to sort of give them, to use an English expression, sort of the cold shoulder. We weren't going to... Well, of course, this was completely confusing to almost everybody other than an English speaker. And in the end, I was roundly told off for allowing this process to develop as the chair. And I was also personally castigated for speaking such rapid English and even for holding the session in English altogether. So this
by
was
the French?
Well, my French would have offended everybody, not least the French. So I just suggest that was an early learning experience for us. What it taught us was that we had to make sure that we took time with our processes, that we very clearly made sure that we were speaking the same language. And by that I mean that when we talked about a procedure that we were going to use, that everybody understood that procedure, because even though you say we're going to do this, everybody in the room has a different idea about what this is. And the obvious example being, you know, motions of no confidence, which are well understood by English speakers but were completely alien to others. So we have to take our time, we have to bring everybody on board. But once we've done that, let me finish on a positive note. Having done that, and although we took some time, by bringing all the CCTLD managers together and forming them into a group, they now form one of the more successful elements of the ICANN model. They are reasonably cohesive, they are doing excellent work on developing internationalized domain names, and so the end result, if you like, is worth taking the time and getting the process right.
Thank you very much, Peter. Okay. I think you saw a relative diversity of ideas, and as people were speaking, I was jotting down a few concepts that I want to recap before we move to the next thing. One element was that was mentioned by Danielle was the fact that you can use in processes your own process to design your process. It's not always the case, but it's an interesting avenue to think about. Avery was mentioning something that I'm very, very close to, the fact that you develop multi-stakeholder personalities yourself. You have multiple hats successively or simultaneously. I don't know if Olga Cavalli is in there, but she's beating me on that because she's actually having all the hats at the same time. She's speaking in the GigaNet, she's in the GAC, and she's in the GNSO now, for those who are familiar with the internal ICANN system. Renata was mentioning the evolution of a huge body, which is the UN system, that is trying to accommodate progressively, and I wouldn't link that with what Muggins was mentioning about the attempt by United Nations organizations to include other actors. Some are more advanced or have more history in this than others, but the key element that came from Muggins is that engaging the actors early on is very important. I will not get too much on Augusto's mention and reference on dictatorship period, but it's interesting to see how you can think about a multi-stakeholder framework in a political environment that is, at the political level, not even under a democratic system. So if we think that multi-stakeholder governance is a step forward after a representative democracy, how much a leap it is when you're in a dictatorship. Thomas was mentioning this sort of wrong answer to a right question, like, why don't we integrate everybody in nice big governmental delegations? Doesn't work. This is a very major lesson from the WSIS. It doesn't work for governments, and it doesn't work for the people who are included. I quote the notion of incubators and making things emerge, like having test beds. I think a bit like laboratories here. You test, you try something, and it evolves into something efficient. I found an interesting remark also in Art mention of the environment of deconstruction that he was referring to, like the decomposition or the restructuring of AT&T and entity. Sometimes when things are reconstructing or are decomposed, deregulated, or emerging, it's the right moment to establish new models. One point he made as well is the importance of outside players and engaging actors who are not the insiders so that they cannot block something. And rapidly, David mentioning how to call a task force. And also the point that was raised by Peter about the diversity of and managing diversity, and especially the question of language. And we'll come to that later, that the reference frameworks for people is not necessarily. In order to move into the next stage, because we're already forward, I would like to share with you just briefly one slide, one concept, which is that when you're talking about governance of policy development, you basically, in any case, or as generically as possible, go through five stages that are basically the same. One is you initiate the process. You raise an issue. You begin a process. Then you go through an iterative drafting period. It can take ages. If you draft a treaty, it can take 20 years. But basically, it's the drafting phase. When you're done, you get the adoption phase, which can take a long time. In governmental processes, between signature and ratification, you can have 20 years. Then you get the whole implementation, which sometimes in international treaties is even later on. And I'm not even talking about the last point in international order, which is enforcement. The two last ones are usually completely forgotten in many regimes, and this is one of the reasons why they don't work. To finish the diagram, it actually comes back because you evaluate the regime if you are lucky enough that it worked, and sometimes you start a new process. What I want to mention to segue into the next phase is that what we're discussing today is just the first one, the initiation, with four major questions that are listed in the papers that are distributed. The first one is, how do you set the agenda? Who has the right to say, I want to study this issue to be studied? You know, in international organizations, if you don't have an agreement among all the governments to simply put an issue on the agenda, the issue is not on the agenda. Look at what climate change did and how long it took. So who puts it? How do you put it? And so on. And maybe I'd like Danielle a bit later on to comment on, specifically in the W3C process, how you can enter something in the thing, and maybe Avery as well, regarding IETF or equivalent. The second thing is, once you've decided you want to address an issue, how do you frame this issue? How do you name it? How do you take the different dimensions? And in particular, in ICANN, but in internet governance issues in general, you usually have four dimensions. It's the technical, the economic, the social, and the political dimensions. How you engage the stakeholders to address those four issues is a very delicate thing. How do you set up a working group? Who are the stakeholders who will participate? What is the methodology? What is the procedure for setting one? And finally, in what kind of document, in process document, is this whole process described? I just wanted to share this with you because, of course, in the remaining time, we will not cover everything. But I want to put it forward to guide the discussion and ask the different panelists, we'll come to specific points, to somehow contribute. And I would like to encourage also those of you in the session, in the public, who want to contribute to this comment just by making a reference also to a personal experience, to raise your hand and contribute, because we'd like to have this a bit interactive. And finally, I cannot resist. I have a personal fondness for the notion of the five blind men and the elephant. And I should have quoted as well another thing, which is an HSBC advertisement that some of you may have seen, which is a different viewpoint is very often a point, a different point of view is very often a viewpoint for a point where you're not. It's just, if I'm looking at a specific issue from a governmental angle, I have a different perspective. A technician will have a different perspective, but as the five blind men and the elephant show, it doesn't necessarily mean that one is contradicting the other. The challenge is, how do you get all the stakeholders to paint a more complete elephant? And what we're discussing here is, how can you put in place processes to paint a complete elephant? So I'd like to come back rapidly on two elements. First to Danielle on this notion of how do you input something? And second to Avery, because she has a particular field of activity that is described in the paper, which is related to Lapland in the north of Sweden. And I think the question of the cultural diversity and the reference frameworks is an interesting thing to mention as a point. Danielle, you might want to... Doesn't work? Yeah. Yeah, okay. Go.
Okay. So it's an interesting circle. For W3C, the initiation is actually called the activity proposal. And it comes from the community. It's a document that actually explained that it's the right time to draft something because the adoption is going to be easy. So, I mean, the initiation is supposed to be a study of the whole circle, in a sense. And the way it works is that the proposal would go to the multi-stakeholder community and ask them if they want to work on that, if they are opposed to work on that. If they want to work on that, will they provide resource to draft the technical specification?
How do you concretely submit? You just send
send an email. You send an email with a proposal that has a specific template with, those questions. What is the implementation plan? You know, when in the process of this activity of W3C you plan to implement something?
So what
are the partners that you already have? So it's a proposal coming from the community that start an activity, and it's reviewed by the community. There is no voting, really. It's, people express interest. If there is opposition from a sort of substantive part of the community, then we have to understand why and discuss with the person.
So if we just take this, I understand that there is a template that has been established that you more or less fill in.
HTML.
Any member from the community, because the W3C is a consortium with members, which is not the case with all the other organizations.
Yeah.
But if you're a member, you just fill a template, you send it in, and people comment.
Exactly. Okay. And the other thing is that multi-stakeholder is something that I would think that the IETF community and the W3C community has always been involved in a sort of using or living in. So for us, it's not a surprise when we see government, people in academia, and industry, and any civil society around the same table. We've been dominated by industry, so at some point, multi-stakeholder meant having Microsoft and Netscape in the same room. But it's no longer the case. So now we are in a situation where it's actually get to the point where we have government agency that are doing procurement that wants to look at web standards, and so that's. It's really shaping up.
Okay. So I keep the notion of template. During the preparation, Art was mentioning the notion of stakeholder in the title of the session. And actually, multi-stakeholder is not necessarily the way we understand it here as government, civil society, and private sector. I will ask Art to make just one comment on that, and maybe Renata...
Yes, the organizations that I talked about earlier
ETSI in Europe, ATIS in the U.S., TTC in Japan, and the ITU globally, all are made up of members of their own constituency. And so one of the issues that we always had was that the process that we have for what initially was called the Interregional Telecommunications Standards Conference, and as we added more members so that now we have China and Korea and Canada and Australia and the ITU representing the rest of the world, that as we've expanded in that regard, we're now called the Global Standards Collaboration and continues to operate. But the stakeholders are each organizations that have their own membership. So we can't go beyond the initiation phase. This is basically a process to promote collaboration among groups at the early stage so you can promote global standards and do it at a stage where you have not locked into your positions so that you can each work individually as a stakeholder with each of the stakeholders in the Global Standards Collaboration being a very significant organization but made up of service providers, equipment suppliers, government purchasers, end users, et cetera. So stakeholders has a much different connotation in this context.
So the idea is that it can be more generic than just the tripod, yes, and that it's basically the stakeholders that is the important thing, and the stakeholders have to be adapted to the given issue. Renata, you wanted to make a comment.
I just want to make some observation because most of us have gone through the VISIS, the World Summit Information Society, and we have been there from day one. I just want to say, how has it changed and how the UN, with all its bureaucracy, has also evolved through these mechanisms, and how much does even the Internet Governance Forum, which is nevertheless also an outspring out of this, mm-hmm, makes and changes the UN. And I think
You mean that there's a template in the UN that any NGO can fill in so that it gets on the agenda on the UN?
We can really, when we bring written oral statements, particularly written statements, and have many signatures. And the more you then also lobby governments and the secretariat and some governments, you are absolutely able. And that has always been the case. But now the multi-stakeholderism, that word, took a while until it sunk in the UN. It is there because clearly the VISIS was a UN summit. They cannot avoid looking at the outcome, the outcome is now very complex, but we have also the ECOSOC specific outcome and the ECOSOC commission which is looking at it. And it is the first commission ever in the UN which has now to apply the multi-stakeholder principle. So that gives us an enormous leeway. We have to still see in which way it works slowly because it's not overnight, but it has definitely changed the perception. And each time we have to see in which way we can move just one step forward. But it depends each time also what is a very, very good issue which we bring forward in that direction. And I think that is exactly, we have many things which we can do, formally and informally.
What I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the notion of percolation of the methodology from one entity to the next. But I think we can see the difference between the W3C mechanism where the membership just feeds in and the system starts without pre-filtering and the traditional international system that requires a long lobbying on that. Avery, one element on the addressing different cultures and the assumptions, I would say, what kind of lessons can you draw from your interaction with the groups that you work with that could be applicable to here?
Okay, yeah, you had asked about, first of all, you mentioned Lapland, and Lapland is actually not the name they use. And in fact, Lapland and Laps is almost like the proverbial N-word in the U.S. So it's the Sapmi population. I mean, it's called Sapmi, and it's the Sami, and it's the northern Arctic regions of Norway, Sweden, Finland, and a bit of Russia called the Kola Peninsula, are basically a population very loosely gathered. This was, and it was interesting to see how this evolved. In some cases, it was almost like a game of telephone, you know, where you whisper, and I know this game has many different names in many different countries, but where you whisper, and I learned several of the names once but forgot them, you whisper something into one ear, they whisper it into another, and at the end you find out, do you have the same phrase? This is a project started by a group of reindeer herders, women, who basically had the same problem that, you know, women who work always have, which is how do you do two things? And they wanted a little bit of internet connection while they were in their semi-nomadic wandering. And so they approached a bunch of university researchers saying, how do we get internet access? Those university researchers contacted a technologist who happened to be me, who heard the problem completely wrong, who did not hear a question, how do you get some internet access up here? They heard, how do you bring the internet up to Sapmi? So then the next step, and this is in building what became a community that is working together, a multi-stakeholder. I approached the Interplanetary Network people because I had heard that they had solved a similar problem. Then they got back, at which point we went to the Sami village. And the Sami village basically listened to all this, decided whether this was something they wanted to get involved in. From there, it went to the Sami parliament, who listened to all this and decided, was this something they wanted to see happen? At each step, it changes a little bit. The words, the scope of the project becomes different. Eventually, then, it makes it to the regional, national, and international organizations and people that get involved in funding it and doing it. So, and this is something I always do to the nice drawings you do. In even one of those initiation small loops, you end up with a lot of iteration and a lot of circles where at each thing, the actual problem that you're working on changes, and then you keep having to bring it back. So every time it got changed because another group worked on it, you would go back to the original Sami women who had this, how do I get some internet access question, and sort of say, are you still behind this project? Do you still see it this way? And no, they wouldn't, and it would go back. So even within the defining of the project, which took 3 years almost to build the multi-stakeholder group, it constantly goes through a revolution, even in that simple first arch.
I wanted to bring in something that is absolutely completely out of the pure internet discussions we have, although it's connected in terms of project. Because the assumption that we share the same cultural framework is usually a cause of many misunderstandings. It's not because we're all here that when we hear one word, we actually understand the same thing. And so during the preliminary discussions, Art was using the expression, do we have the same vernacular? It's a caution mark on all processes of that sort, that one of the first thing is when people are arguing about one specific term, do they simply mean or understand the same thing? And we understand we have different cultures where people are dressed completely differently. But when we're all relatively in an environment who speak the same language, sort of, as you said with the Anglo-Saxon wording, it's not always the case. I make a pause here. As you understand, there are 11 speakers, and it's a management, an exercise in frustration. It's not about allowing everybody to be able to speak many, many times. I hope that the different mentions by other members of the panel are useful for the members of the panel as well. I would like maybe, with your permission, to give the floor to a few people. I'll try to... the first here, and then Everton. Ah, there's another one.
Slavka Antonova, Massey University, New Zealand. I've been studying multi-stakeholderism for years, so I can bring a kind of a theoretical perspective to the discussion here, which is rooted in practice and very many valuable lessons can be taken from there, of course. But my concern is mainly with conflating the notions of multi-stakeholderism. When the governments get involved into multi-stakeholderism, they tend to substitute public consultation for the real, pure multi-stakeholderism. Multi-stakeholderism.
Does everybody nod here? Do I?
Yeah, and they self-satisfy. They satisfy themselves with thinking, okay, we are doing multi-stake. We are fashionable. We are really up to date here. But in practice, the multi-stakeholderism notion emerged still in the 70s in the United States on the local level, when people experienced some problem in some communities, and they used to get together and to resolve these issues with or without governmental participation. That was not the problem. So it's mostly, multi-stakeholderism is mostly about, I mean, by definition, mostly about the bottom-up grassroots initiative, which emerges because people realize their interdependencies. There is a problem, a single player cannot resolve it, and they get together to resolve it. So, I mean, I'm really concerned with this conflation of the notion, so I would like some reflections here.
Thank you. If I may, for the reporting and so on, the first point you made was not mistake consultation for multi-stakeholderism. But the second one is something we didn't really address, but that goes into the issue scoping, framing, and naming, is how do you define an issue of common concern or interest? But basically, the starting point is that people share a problem that they cannot solve alone. And I think it's an important thing. I think Everton had raised his hand first, then you, and Bent. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Everton.
Everton, just one remark. Of course, we never have time enough. There are 15 minutes for the rest. So if you could, I think the first intervention was very positive in that respect, try to insert a formulation according to this, an issue.
Certainly. I'll follow your advice. In fact, this is an exciting discussion, and I'm sure it would deserve a whole week conference so that we could further develop it. But, you know, the concept of multi-stakeholderism is a concept that my government, and I apologize for those who don't know me, I am from the government of Brazil, foreign ministry. We endorse it and have said that officially. And so I think the question is not if, now we are talking about how. And how to ensure that within a multi-stakeholder environment, we will be able to deliver. We will be able to deliver to the expectations of the community. So at the national level, and we have here Mr. Gadelha, he could explain better than me, there is a the participation is ensured by means of a presidential decree, which means that there is the government of Brazil making sure that the multi-stakeholder process is in place and will be observed and will enforce the results of the multi-stakeholder process. It means that the process workflow that you are showing on the screen has as a guarantee that it will be observed, the government. That's at the national level. Now let's take, for example, at the IGF in which we are. We have the United Nations Secretary General to organize it. And there are many issues of importance to set the scene of the debate and to understand what is the extent, what is the mandate, and so on, which derived from the Tunis agenda. And so there is always some instance in which there is a governmental role to make sure that this process will work the way it is designed and to enforce it. Now, having said that, you know that perhaps it's not an easy task for government representatives to participate in some of the so-called multi-stakeholder initiatives. Like, let's take, for instance, the example of IETF. I heard that it's mainly a business-oriented organization, but certain government agents, representatives are welcome to participate. But then that's different, you mean. I think that there is a role for the governments to ensure the process itself, the process that you are showing, to enforce it. And that's how I would like to contribute, and by asking perhaps people to comment on what should be the role of the governments in this process, not only as a mere participant or contributor to it, but as making sure that it will be observed in the end. Thank you.
May I rephrase your question in distinguishing two elements? One element is that
multi-stakeholder process has to be structured and guaranteed by some entity that is in charge. It's part of the, it goes for CGI.BR, it goes for ICANN, it goes for others. It's almost an element of the internal accountability. The second thing is, on your part, an answer, and I think in the case of this workshop, it should be a question, which is, who does guarantee this? Is it only the government? Is it the governments with others, knowing that all the stakeholders are both part of the process and potentially in a role of convener? Here in the IGF, it's an interesting question of seeing what is the respective roles of actors in organizing the IGF and in participating. But I would distinguish the two. Have you and then I said Vint Cerf. No mic?
We have a mic.
Ah, yeah, there's a mic. That's the gentleman. If we can follow the same pattern, trying to identify something that is an angle of approach or a new question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Michael Carlin, Caring for Our Future project, which participated in the Millennium process. I'd just like to mention, to answer partly the question how. We have not made progress in systemically integrating monetary, economic, social or environmental policies. The Millennium Process, the Millennium Declaration, recognized formally all the countries that signed it that there is a need to address systemic issues. Step one at the United Nations, today we still do not have a main committee under the UN General Assembly to address systemic issues. Therefore, governments have no basis on which to get together to work out the linkages between monetary fiduciarity, monetary excessive leveraging, the crisis that we have today, environmental depletion, forced consumption, human rights, and a whole lot of other areas. And as we have increasing dependency on the internet is our enabling tool for interactive communication to bring the stakeholders together. What is the starting point? The protocol of the United Nations requires that at least one government put on the UN General Assembly the request to set up a main committee on the UN General Assembly to address systemic issues. And so far, the governments have refrained from doing that, mainly for political reasons, not for technical reasons. And we won't get anywhere until we start system-wide coherence in processes. And IT can help us that. That's the point I'd like to make. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Actually, when you started, I misheard monetary, and I understood monitoring. And I think monitoring is also an important element that I would like to bring in the debate. But systemic issues is important. Very quick remarks, because... But not getting into
much. Very quick, but I think since this year, the ECOSOC has been strengthened. And you know that there are two new mechanisms on ECOSOC exactly to monitor the implementation of the Millennium Development Goals. And that is a number of them. And so we have that. And we have also the Cooperation Development Forum, which brings more cooperation, cohesion of what governments are doing together. And that is new since this year, July. So I hope that ECOSOC will be really moving forward in that.
As a matter of fact, I think that the internet in general is and should be considered a global issue at the same level of importance than the climate change or other issues because it's so underlying everything. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. I was just listening to the woman from New Zealand, which brought us some of the theoretical background, and I think it's really useful to think about a little bit what is the definition of multi-stakeholder, what is the difference between a normal governance form and multi-stakeholder. Because when I was listening to what has been said, I suddenly thought that, well, my country, Switzerland, we have a multi-stakeholder governance model with the fact that if I am a teacher and I do not like something in a law, I can go together to the other teachers and collect signatures and start an initiative. And I have this agenda setting possibility for every Swiss citizen installed in the political system, which is called direct democracy, for instance. And for instance, also we have a very multi-stakeholder government. We've got people from the business sector in the government, we've got people from civil society in the government, and we also have people from the public administration. So what's the difference between a normal kind of government structure with regard to a multi-stakeholder structure? But I think there is a difference. If you have a look at the IGF, for instance, this is an area where there are some established structures, some of them younger, some of them older, but maybe those structures are not yet that developed to live up to kind of a inclusiveness or representativity. And the IGF is maybe adds to provide a platform for this, these 4 points that helps the other existing mechanisms to take into account new ideas or problems or get aware of problems and to improve and reform themselves in order that they themselves also could be able to provide at the later stage for this mechanism. And I think this is one of the merits that the IGF has. Thank you.
It's what you mean also is the difference between decision shaping in general and the decision making thing. Karen.
That helps me address an issue that I'd like to take up with this, because for me this is a very kind of traditional way of approaching the development of quite hard legislation and regulation. But I think a lot of what we're seeing in the work we're involved with, particularly in relation to internet and related policy, is you have a lot of soft policy being developed by different stakeholders, not only governments, not only the intergovernmental system. And I think that poses us with a whole lot of different challenges and opportunities. And one thing that I feel is very important in all of this, let's face it, I mean, really what we're talking about here is people that have problems that they want to solve. And those people can come from all kinds of different, if we want to call them, stakeholder groups. My organization often transforms the title a little bit from multi-stakeholder to multiple stakeholders, meaning there are just many, many different and diverse peoples who need to come together to solve complex problems. And something that was very interesting for us in a workshop yesterday was addressing this whole question of developing some kind of mechanisms that will ensure that people have access to the information and the processes they need to engage in public policy processes. And that doesn't have to be hard-coded either. And I think that these are the kinds of mechanisms that we can actually start working with at home in our communities. And in fact, it's used a lot in terms of, let's say, something like content regulation. You know, there's actually a lot of soft policy mechanisms, opt-in, voluntary codes, that are actually becoming quite significant in terms of policy processes. And if you look at this, it's actually very difficult to know how to intervene in this kind of a cycle with something like that, because A, you're not really sure who's making the policy, or it's being made, say, within a particular community that you don't have access to. And so I think that if we can look at how we can try to encourage all of the mechanisms and organizations involved in public policy processes to adopt these kind of good practices in terms of openness and access to information, openness in terms of how decision-making processes work, transparency, you know, then I think people will take up that opportunity and they'll get involved at the point at which they feel they need to.
You're raising is the question that is more or less addressed in the charters down there in terms of transparency of the process and knowing when to intervene. I think I have a few comments. This
and then hello, thank you. I'm a journalist, and since you brought up the elephant, I also will bring something, which is, you know, the optimist is the one who commands a bunch of pessimists. So when you are a lot of people and trying to get together to bring up an idea, people who are in command usually are happy and so forth, and the basis perhaps they are not. Of course, we are dealing here with an adolescent phase of the internet, which is out of the technical discussions And as Mrs. Karen pointed out, it goes to the soft policies. And I wonder if the organization, the multi-stakeholder way of doing this will go to some place and get some achievements. Technical, it's much easier. Mr. Art, ITU solved lots of problems, and now they don't know how to solve it. So you cannot get too big if you want to accomplish something. Too big, what I mean is objectives too big. And just remember the past is, I'm getting old, of course. And why countries get together, they have the diplomatic language, and they try to achieve something because they are empowered to do it. I wonder what this organization has the power to do it. Who empowered them? Ah, it's the people. Are they elected? The optimist commands the banner of pessimists. Thank you.
This is a major question that we, of course, can only scratch, which is the foundation for legitimacy of any multi-stakeholder process, which is the counterpart of the guaranteeing at the top. Vint.
Thank you, Bertrand. It's Vint Cerf. One of the problems of making multi-stakeholder structures work is achieving participation of the stakeholders. And it starts with identifying them, figuring out who are the stakeholders or what categories of stakeholders are there that have to be identified. And we've run into difficulties with that categorization in ICANN, for example. Then there's enabling participation. You can see the difficulties where multiple languages might be involved. Physical travel could be difficult, the expenses and the like. A third element, this is intended to be a question for you to reflect on, and how do you achieve these objectives. Another one is trying to deal with common goals versus conflicting agendas. One of the things that makes multi-stakeholder organizations work well, or can make them work well, is if, in fact, all the stakeholders have a common goal and they're working together to achieve it. The more difficult case is the one where they, in fact, have conflicting agendas, and somehow the multi-stakeholder process has to resolve the tension. Another fundamental element in success, I think, is achieving some mutual respect among the stakeholders. That isn't always the case. Some of the stakeholders are sufficiently in opposition to each other that, in fact, they are disrespectful of each other, and that makes maybe it's just my voice is dying. It makes it difficult to have fruitful kinds of discussion if there is real disrespect. And finally, I think in the presence of respect, you can have disagreement. And when there is disagreement, one of the most valuable exercises is to figure out what's the nature of the disagreement. Do you have different models in your head? And you might be disagreeing about something because you don't share a common model. And one of the things, Bob Kahn and I used to have really, amazing arguments about the design of the Internet. And at some point after a third or fourth of these, we said, wait a minute, sometimes the reason we have these big disagreements is that we both have different models of what we're talking about, and we're really disagreeing about the models, and we just don't know that. So we would stop as soon as we thought we were entering into a big explosive debate. We said, okay, wait a minute, let's examine the models first and see whether at least we have the same model that we can disagree about.
The framework.
So I'm just posing these as problems that arise in the creation of successful multi-stakeholder groups, and wonder whether any of you have some thoughts along those lines.
Thank you, Vint. And actually, one of the outcomes of the early stages is the production of issues paper. Now I have the traditional, usual major problem. Two things. There are people who want to make comments, but we will not have the time. Once again, I encourage you to use the slip of paper in the threefold thing and make a mention of your name, your email address, and we will be doing, of course, the reporting back tomorrow in the session, but I pledge that will produce, or I will help produce at least a summary of what has been discussed here, and I will send it to anybody that has given his address. I cannot promise that if you ask a question, we will answer personally on the question, but maybe it can be integrated. As a closure, I will not make a closure. I would like to maybe give the floor to Peter, and there was somebody else. I would like also maybe Valerie to say something, because I didn't give the floor that much. There are many people who could have spoken more. Peter, I wanted to just have a feedback on the applicability to one specific element within ICANN, which is the reform of the internal processes and how this applies to involving the actors very early on, including on a very specific case in point, which is the ALAC, the GAC, and in an informal manner. Is that of any help to bring the actors very early on, or is it better to have them intervene through their organizations, if you see what I mean? And you certainly have personal comments apart from that.
I'm not sure I really understand
the
question.
That means
and I'm not, with respect, I'm not sure how helpful it will be, because it requires such an understanding of ICANN and the ICANN processes. I think the question is about internal reform of ICANN. Perhaps I can jump up to a higher level than that particular one. One of the fundamental requirements, I think, for ICANN is this self-review, to do what Vint was just describing about the way he and Bob were looking at the internet. You do have to stop, and it's the sort of thing that's on your diagram as well. You do need to stop and keep asking, is this the same question? And Avery said the same thing about the exercise that she was engaged in. We do that formally with bylaws that require it. We have a process where we engage consultants and come through and do that. We run the risk with all of our processes of falling into this other trap that was mentioned about consultation. We publish the results. We invite consultation. A frequent complaint about ICANN and ICANN's processes is that people who submit in response to that consultation process don't feel that they're getting that heard. So we are working on a way of first of all, acknowledging the fact that someone is we're going to have automatic responses that say, first of all, yes, your message has been received, because at the moment you send it in, there's not even an acknowledgement that your email may have got lost. So we are looking to deal with the human side of that. People want to know that their message has been safely received, and then we want to move on to the next step of actually trying, if we can, of actually responding to that, including when a decision is made, of actually mentioning some of the issues and explaining why input has been rejected or has not been adopted in the way it was put forward. So I've just come from a session on human rights, I think, and I defended the ICANN process. We do have to be aware always that we're dealing with humans. All of these things, people want to participate. They want their contributions acknowledged. So at the same time as the model is being looked at, you've got to make sure also that the human issues are attended to. I don't know whether that's enough of a response, Petra.
It's perfectly fits, actually, and one of the main feeling I have about all this is that small, minor changes, little elements, can transform the nature of a process, sometimes more than major changes. Augusto, Valerie, and it's over.
I would like to comment one point. Internet today is something which is affecting every sector of the society and every people. So people want to participate. People want to know that the people who are ruling the internet, they have not the power, but the authority of doing that. They want to feel sure that the people who are really ruling, making the rules, they are doing it for the benefit of everybody. So there is a demand for that. Now, government, to the actually, we opened a box, Pandora, when the internet started in 20 years ago, because it was something which people often refers to anarchic, in the sense that everyone wanted to participate, everybody wanted to say how it should grow. And so we are actually with this problem in the hands. We have something which is explosive, something which is affecting everybody, and we want to find something which has the authority to say, yes, we are doing it right. Now, government in certain parts of the world, but mainly when they are democratic, I think they can be a power to hold this multi-stakeholder environment which could be productive. But I don't want to see government to rule things. And so I believe that one of the problems we today have in making this multi-stakeholder environment to work is really to hold the participation of each of these stakeholders, let's say participation on this arena. So this is something which is been evolving, is getting maturing of this organization, and is not something which is not very complex. It's not very simple. It's very complex matter. So thank you.
Thank you. It's pointing the finger once again, as Everton was saying, on the different question of participation of governments within processes and in the organization of processes.
I would like to, I think, just say two things or reflect on two things. I think that in any multi-stakeholder process, a good amount of time should be spent at the outset really figuring out what the value proposition of sitting together in the first place is. And perhaps that's so simple that we tend to overlook it. But when we, I think it was Vint who said, when we mistrust or when we feel, what do you really have to add to this? Then what's really going on is we haven't quite figured out the value proposition of sitting with somebody as opposed to across the table in an argumentative fashion with somebody. So in any multi-stakeholder process, I think if we devote a certain amount of time to saying to ourselves, this conversation is richer because I have you here, you give me something I don't have. That mental model is the construct that I think leads ultimately to success, and that incorporates issues of respect, but I think also of trust that the other parties have something of value to add. The other thing I'd just like to end with, Bertrand, is that a lot of this model, I think Karen made this point, maybe also is structured around harder forms of collaboration. Much of the internet, I think, revolves around softer forms. And so the extent to which this is necessarily going to be the immediate fit in internet-type discussions, I guess, is a question we have to think about more.
Thank you, Valerie. I'll grab two brief final comments, unless we are kicked out.
Thank you. Just one little thing. We should remember the last word of the title of what we're dealing with, process. The multi-stakeholder process is a process. The multi-stakeholder process is a process to provide all of us, whether we be at government or international organizations and where we are, with the best possible conditions to make our decisions on. It's not another instrument to meddle decision-taking. It's not another instrument to make it possible for government or others to escape their responsibility for taking decisions. But it is a process through which they can take more intelligent and better founded decisions on what they're dealing with. So let me just stop there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just to be a little bit provocative before we leave, maybe there might be cases where one stakeholder alone, especially governments, are not able to take decisions. And maybe now we've been talking about multi-stakeholder initiation or discussion, but maybe we might have to think about whether it would be necessary in the future to have multi-stakeholder decisions as well, and not only just multi-stakeholder discussions. This is just a... and the last thing before I leave, I just wanted to say thank you in the name of all of us to Bertrand for taking this initiative and starting. Thank you. So thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. That's kind. The two last words. One, before you leave, go in the back and see whether there's anything left that you want to take back. Second, please leave your coordinates. Third, my deepest apologies and my sincere thanks for all the people who accepted to come and to say just a few words. It was the challenge of a big panel, but I hope that you appreciated the perspective provided by others. And the very important element is all we've been discussing here is about informal processes for very early stages, and try to think that you can plug that in any discussion that you're involved in. Every time somebody asks you to address an issue, try to get this discussion in mind and say, minute, have we explored the different actors that can participate? Thank you very much. There is another panel on public policy tonight. You're highly welcome to continue the discussion on this thread. Thank you so much.